This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Autism is one of the most debilitating and least understood psychological conditions. Those who suffer from it live entirely inside themselves. They recoil at human touch, resist eye contact. They're driven to repeat certain behaviors endlessly. They rarely speak except in rigid, script-like ways. Few emerge from that inner world, and little is known about what causes it or how to treat it. Sean Barron was autistic from birth. A neurological pediatrician told his parents that autism was incurable. But as Sean got into his late teens, the condition began to fall away. He now works as a rehabilitation aide in a nursing home in Ohio. He and his mother, Judy Barron, have written a book about his childhood called There's a Boy in Here. Sean told me about some of his earliest memories.
A lot of them involved very repetitive kinds of behaviors. I remember very vividly and strongly being about 6 or 8 months old, crawling across the rug that we had in our small house and picking at the carpet fibers and really testing them. I guess I was sort of testing not only the way they feel, but whether or not they'd be the same every time I crawled over them. So it was very repetitive, and I remember going through very fixated stages. I remember having fascinations for things like chains and speedometers and that sort of thing. And I remember doing these kinds of activities unabated for hours on end.
Is that the world that you lived in then, one that was full of fascination with objects, with light, with repetitive movement?
Pretty much so, yeah. I would say that dominated my early years, probably for the most part, certainly before I went to school. I remember spending hours at a time out in the yard and even in the house throwing things down the register and really almost testing physical laws. It was as if gravity might work one moment and then may or may not work the next.
One thing you say in the book was, I was the fastest person in the world. Can you describe the speed at which you lived inside?
Well, it felt like I was just tormented. It felt like I was followed by demons almost, and I had to keep running and keep in motion to fight them off. And when I said I was the fastest person in the world, I really felt like that literally, but also figuratively, because I felt that anxious all the time, and I felt like the faster I moved, the more I could control my environment and control the anxiety that felt like it could swallow me up at any time.
Who were these demons? What were these demons?
It's hard to really describe them, pinpoint them, but it was just more of a feeling. You know, it wasn't really even a physical sensation. I just remember being born terrified for some reason. I never felt the kind of security that most children have or can get from being held or fed and so forth. And those things never seemed to matter to me. If anything, being held seemed to increase my pain and anxiety. And I fought it off. I felt trapped.
Judy Barron, can you describe what it was like being a parent to Sean when he was a youngster?
Well, first of all, my husband and I were very young. And we were 21 and 22, I guess. And felt like children ourselves, and we didn't know anything about babies. But Sean's behavior was so bizarre that after the first couple of months, it began to dawn on us that this was an unusual set of circumstances we had found and found ourselves with. And he, once he began to move around, and he didn't actually walk for longer than a couple of weeks until he started really running, and then he almost never walked again. And when he became mobile, then it was very clear that he couldn't be stopped from doing the repetitive behaviors that, as he said, he needed to do. But of course, we didn't know that it was something he needed. All we saw it as was destructive, repetitive, endless, and hypnotic behavior.
You describe your fury with him. I mean, a fury that scared yourself.
Oh, yes. Well, at first, I thought, I've got to stop him from doing this. This is silly. He goes on for hours doing the same thing over and over. This can't be right. And so I thought, I've got to stop him. I'll just substitute something else. I'll read to him. I'll take him outside and we'll play in the yard or whatever. But he could not be stopped. And as soon as I let go of him, he would, if he could, go right back to what he was doing before. And if he couldn't, he'd pick something else up and start doing the same repetitive behavior with that, throwing things into trees or throwing things out of the fence that we had, which was like a chicken wire sort of thing. And the odd thing about it was that it just was relentless. He just wouldn't stop doing it. He wouldn't sort of get bored like other kids do and sit down and do something else. He would just keep at it until we physically moved him to another place. And I didn't know what to do about that. And the only thing I felt was he doesn't even know I'm here. I seem invisible to him because he doesn't listen to me. When I raise my voice, he didn't hear me. So, of course, I got louder and louder and started yelling and did all the things I swore I'd never do as a mother, in which I don't to this day believe. And the frustration built mm-hmm. and the fear that there was really something wrong increased month by month. And in no time, I was lost.
Sean, do you remember your mother's early rage at you?
That's pretty much all I remember, because it seemed like it happened so frequently, and I was constantly stopped for doing the things that I felt I needed to do and gave me security. So it was a stalemate very early on, and even for the into my teen years, the things that I remember most vividly are being shaken, yelled at, and scolded and so forth for one reason or another. And it was very difficult. It was just, I don't remember the times when I was praised or encouraged even, because just all the other stuff was going on and it was always a constant battle of wills.
Judy, when did you begin to go for professional help, to go to doctors, psychiatrists, psychologists to find out what was happening with Sean?
When Sean was four, we went to the first psychologist. We had had trouble finding anybody. We lived in a small Ohio community, and we didn't even know who to ask. I didn't know who to go to. I didn't know what was wrong. So, I mean, I, of course, asked the pediatrician constantly. I would say to him, he does this, and he does this, and he eats only these foods, and he eats enormous quantities, and I can't stop his crying. He won't listen. He won't look at me.
What did the doctor say?
And he said, he would look at me and sort of wink and say, oh, you new mothers, you're just all alike, and bless your hearts, I had a call from a woman the other night, and so on. He just totally dismissed me. But then we went to, at the end of that year, because Sean still was not speaking, we went to a neurological pediatrician who first gave us the word autism. He said, your son is autistic. And I said, well, I mean, my first reaction was, well, at least it's called something. I mean, maybe it is not me.
So autism was a comforting diagnosis?
For about 2 seconds. And then he said, it's incurable. It's an unknown cause. There's nothing that can be done about it. And he said he'll probably get worse instead of better. But he was wrong. And it was a terrible prediction. I didn't know what to make of it. My husband and I just were stunned. We just didn't know what to do.
Well, let me ask you, because 20, 25 years ago, when Sean was young, parents of autistic children were often described as cold. They were called refrigerator parents. That was their explanation for the child's autism.
Mm-hmm.
Were you told that there was something about the way you were as a parent that made Sean the way he was?
Yes. Every professional person we saw from then, at the beginning and all the way through, implied that or said it. Including the first doctor who gave us the diagnosis, who looked only at me as my husband and I sat across the desk from him. And he looked at me with ice blue eyes that I remember to this moment. And he said at one point, having called me mother throughout the questions he was asking me, I said, I really would like you to call me Judy, because it's making me very uncomfortable that you're calling me mother when I'm not your mother. And he said, oh, I see we're having trouble accepting motherhood, aren't we? Well, I mean, I was so angry at that I don't know what I did for the rest of the time. And of course, had I been smarter, I would have confronted him. But I was too weakened at that point to know how to respond. And my husband did sort of, you know, jump in and try to defend me. But the doctor just sort of waved him into silence with one hand and said, go on. to me.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first I want to take a quick break here. And my guests today on Fresh Air are Sean Barron and his mother, Judy Barron. And they have co-authored a book about Sean's childhood. He was diagnosed with autism when he was a young boy. And the book is about each of their stories of his childhood and about his emergence from autism. And the book is called There's a Boy in Here. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking today with Judy Barron and her son, Sean Barron, and they've co-authored a book about Sean and about his early autism and his emergence from autism, and the book is called There's a Boy in Here. What were some of the recommendations? Now, you were given what sounded to be almost like a fatal diagnosis, that this would never be cured. Mm-hmm. What were some of the early treatments, the early things that you tried?
We tried to do everything we did together. We tried for there not to be any divisive techniques going on, where my husband would try something and I would try something else. We talked constantly to Sean. We told him we loved him. We told him why we were stopping him from doing what he did. He didn't understand cause and effect. He didn't know that if he did something that the effect of it would inevitably happen. So we would explain that over and over. We talked so long that I got so tired of the sound of my own voice, as my husband did, but I realized that it did help. It had some effect on Sean that took years to come out, or years to show up, but it was all we could think of to do. You know, I guess we're verbal people, and we kind of believe in good sense, or common sense, I guess, and when we couldn't get any help from people that we took Sean to see, which was more than just the people I've named, we decided we'd do it on our own, that if it was a field nobody really knew anything about anyway, we might as well make our own mistakes. And well, so that's what we did.
Let me ask Sean about that effect, or at least when your parents determined that they would not let you retreat into this world of your own making. How did you deal with that? And I'm talking about when you were young.
Oh, I often responded with rage because, as I was saying before, I interpreted it as either they hated me or they were just trying to stop me and sabotaging all my efforts to do the things that I wanted to do, which, from my point of view, were just simply giving me pleasure and weren't hurting anybody. So I didn't have a clue as to why I was being stopped, even though I may have heard the words, for I didn't have the ability to process it and figure out ideas. And as my mother had said, I didn't have a sense of cause and effect. So when you're lacking those things, it's very difficult to interpret meanings and interpret what's going on and what's being said to you.
You describe certain ritualistic behaviors, even beliefs that developed. One had to do with your fear of turning left when mm-hmm. you were in the car with a family. You had certain beliefs about glasses of water. And you had certain kind of rituals about who was the first person in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could describe this turning left, how that became such a terrifying experience for you.
I just recall turning left produced more anger in me than terror. It was just some rule that I'd made up. I don't really recall specifically why that particular thing took on all the importance, but for some reason it did produce a lot of anger in me when I would see the car turning left, because for some reason I equated a left turn with something bad and a right turn with something good. And on the surface, of course, it doesn't make any sense why anybody would do that, and I unfortunately don't recall exactly why, but I remember that I would do everything I could to gain power or to feel a sense of power over the situation which I couldn't control. Like if the car would go left, I remember ducking down in the seat sometimes so I wouldn't see the actual turn take place. I remember even going so far as to try to counteract the centripetal force, and I would move to the left instead of gravitate toward the right, as would normally take place if a vehicle in motion turned left.
So these rules, as complicated as they were, and as you say now, even as nonsensical as they were part of your need then to create some order in your life, to feel some sense of power.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And to feel some security, too, to try to counteract that feeling of terror and anxiety that I'd felt. It was almost like it was a wall. If you can imagine being between two walls and having the walls slowly closing in on you, that's how it felt. And doing these things sort of, it didn't get rid of the anxiety. It didn't tear down the walls, but it prevented them from moving in further.
Let me ask you, Judy, what it was like to then observe Sean as he got older and perhaps as his behavior became more complicated, how you were able to cope with it. And, for instance, coping with these behaviors, which probably to you looked like they didn't make any sense.
They made no sense to me. What we did was what we had always done. We stuck to the belief in rationality, which was pretty silly because I would say to Sean, it does not matter if we turn left or right. We can't get from here to the store without turning left. It was also very difficult to tell what the system really was that he was inventing because he wasn't verbal about it. He never said, I'm unable to see someone set water glasses down on the table without screaming and getting hysterical and knocking myself backwards off the chair. We just found that out when he did it in some restaurant, and it was all new to me. I thought, what has become of us? What is this? Because looking on at these systems, it was anybody's guess what they were, and he varied them all the time. There wasn't, you know, something clearly defined that then became something in our lives for the next several months. It was always altering and changing, and sometimes one was abandoned and another was put in its place. Obviously, the important thing to him was that he needed a system, and he would invent them on the spot, and it might have to do with my wearing blue on a day when he decided no one in the family could wear blue, and he would just throw himself on the floor in hysterical sobs at the outfit I was wearing, and I didn't know what that meant. And, of course, when you're dealing with things of this extreme nature, you think, okay, I'm going to do everything he wants. I won't wear blue. But, of course, you can't because, I mean, you can't.
Because I varied the rules so much.
Yes.
You know, one day it would be maybe blue, and I would get upset because of the left turns. If we had to get to the A&P, for example, and if they acquiesced to my wishes, we'd still be driving to the A&P.
My guests are Sean and Judy Barron, and their book is called There's a Boy in Here. Well, Sean, when did you begin to make friends? And you talked about being in your teenage years, 16, 17, and I guess your autism beginning to sort of break up.
Yeah, that's certainly an accurate assessment of the situation. I started probably when I was maybe 17 or so, at about the same time I started overcoming it and started coming out of myself, because I was able to look at things completely differently. And I started watching people and how they act and react to situations, and I started even at times trying to copy that.
Well, you say in the book that there was really no grand, Hollywood awakening, that it was really kind of a gradual dissolution, a falling away.
Yeah, well, that was certainly the case, and I wanted to emphasize that so that people wouldn't read the book and think that it was just a sudden overnight occurrence.
Mm-hmm. And for you, Judy, to see him make these tentative steps towards others?
It was an amazing thing to see because it was such a fight for him. He had to fight everything that he didn't know and couldn't do. And, of course, he didn't want to be very overt about it because he was 17 years old and 18 and 19. And at that age, you don't want to admit that you don't know how to put your shoes on and you don't know how to button your shirt.
But he didn't know how to do that?
No. And he didn't know how to tie bows, and he couldn't get the button to match, the right buttonhole for the right button, and he didn't know how to straighten his clothes. He just really couldn't dress himself in that respect. He couldn't do the details anyway.
Did he want your help then?
He did, but he didn't want to ask for it. He felt that he had gotten to an age where he wanted to put the autism behind him, which he clearly did. He wanted to get rid of all traces of it, and he fought that every day of his life, every second of his life. And so it was very hard for him to ask questions. So we kept talking, and we said to him, there isn't any way you can know what you don't know. And I would give him examples of a person who had been without sight suddenly being able to see at the age of 17, who would then have to have explained to him everything he didn't know. You know, he wouldn't know what the colors were. He wouldn't know what the names of things were. And it was pretty much that kind of condition, because his autistic symptoms had kept him from learning so many things that everyone just instinctively picks up as they grow older.
Sean, how would you say you then are marked by your autism? Are there still things that you're learning about the world?
No, in terms of what I've missed out because of my autism, I can quite candidly say no. You know, I'm always learning things all the time. We all are. You know, anybody who admits that they really want to know more about anything in particular, you know, goes out and tries to learn about it. And I'm certainly trying to learn new things all the time in general, but I don't feel held back anymore because of autism.
Did you feel fragile at all? Mentally fragile?
No, I really don't. Now, if you'd asked me that 3 or 4 years ago, I probably would have responded differently, because at that time, I still had a lot of anger toward myself, and I still sometimes would believe that at any time I could slip back partially or wholly to where I had autism once again. But now, no, I don't.
And he had no perspective in those years either, until a couple of years ago. He would think that he had to know things. And, I mean, it was the sort of thing where he'd say, I don't know how to do brain surgery. And I'd say, but Sean, no one knows how to unless... And he wouldn't know that, though. He'd say, oh, then it isn't because I was autistic. And I'd say, no, honey, it's nobody knows.
I didn't have a clue. Figured that if I didn't know how many stories tall the Empire State Building was, it was because of my autism. Somewhere along the line, I should have known that.
Mm-hmm. Because there was no way for him to know.
Terrifying. Mm-hmm.
This is an unusual story, though, isn't it?
Oh, it's extremely unusual.
Very much so, yeah.
I mean, most people who are autistic don't, like Sean, get free of it.
No, they don't. There can be an improvement, and of course, it's a very great range of symptoms, and a lot of autistic people are retarded too, or at least have retarded symptoms. And no, the prognosis is not good, but it can happen. It did happen in Sean's case, and I don't agree with the autism experts who say that it's a lifelong dysfunction for which recovery is impossible, because it is obviously not.
Well, Judy Barron and Sean Barron, I thank you very much for joining us today and telling us about your story.
Thank you, Marty.
Thank you very much.
Sean Barron and Judy Barron's book is called There's a Boy in Here. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.